You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been over a decade since the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, but the legacy of that trial and the political chaos that led up to it are likely to have an impact on our political system for some time to come. In The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, Duquesne University Law School Dean Ken Gormley provides an exhaustive behind-the-scenes account of the lead-up to the impeachment directly from the mouths of the characters involved. It's published by Crown, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dean Gormley to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. It's a great pleasure. I have a good friend, Elizabeth Barron, who is a big fan of your show, so I was looking forward to this.
Well, I was looking forward to talking to you about this. I was curious about the title of your book. I'm guessing that you believe something permanently changed about American political culture during the lead-up to an eventual impeachment of Bill Clinton, because the death of American virtue, is this really the death of American virtue?
Well, the title obviously is supposed to leave something to the imagination, but I can say that what I had in mind when I thought about that, and it was years ago, it's been kind of stuck in my head, was a notion of political virtue. I think that if you look in the mirror at this saga, and it obviously just tore the country apart and divided us down the middle, neither side comes out looking really good. I think there was excess on both sides. I think there was a lack of restraint on both sides. And if anything, it's, I guess, a cautionary tale that we have to really examine this and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Why was there so much animosity toward the Clinton presidency from the start? I remember letters to the Wall Street Journal in the first months of the presidency accusing him of being a socialist or a communist, the same sort of thing that we're seeing today with President Obama. But Then I was wondering, was it politics or, as many suggested, the feeling that Mr. Clinton, as a child of the 60s, represented a major cultural change?
I think it was both, Leonard. Certainly there was this sense before Bill and Hillary Clinton even walked into the White House that he was, you know, an imposter in some ways, that he was a draft dodger and a dope smoker and all these kinds of things, if you remember the different stories. But I do have to say, I spent a lot of time in Arkansas, spent time with friends of Bill Clinton since growing up, going back to Hope and Hot Springs, but also with people who weren't big fans of Bill Clinton. And, you know, it's interesting, when you looked in Arkansas, there was a similar divide. You know, Bill Clinton is a bigger-than-life figure, but he engenders intense feelings of both passionate support and disdain, depending on which side of the line you're on.
Were people gunning for him from the start? The so-called Travelgate scandal occurred just 4 months after he took office.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think more so than any modern president, there were forces aligned early on who wanted to see a regime change if possible. But it's interesting because, as you know, this story you couldn't have made up. I mean, it's more bizarre than any fiction. And as one strong conservative Republican friend of mine said, yes, we came in there carrying the elephant gun, but Bill Clinton gave us the bullets. So it is, I mean, it is true that there were a lot of folks who very early on thought that Bill Clinton did not deserve to occupy the White House. At the same time, this story would not have been possible without him contributing to it.
But where would you place the starting point for this long story that culminated with the impeachment trial?
Well, I place it with Watergate and the consummation of that deal in 1978 with Jim and Susan McDougal and Bill and Hillary Clinton sitting in the Black Eyed Pea restaurant in Little Rock.
Wait, you mean Whitewater, not Watergate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Because Watergate might very well also come to play.
Yes, exactly. Whitewater. I do think that is where it all begins. What's interesting about it is that all of these pieces – Whitewater, Vince Foster suicide, Paula Jones' allegations, the Monica Lewinsky investigation, all swirl together and produce the second impeachment of a president. Early on, I can tell you that I talked to George Stephanopoulos just informally when I was first beginning this project, and I told him that my goal was to talk to both sides, to call it down the middle and to show how all of these pieces were really intertwined, because for the most part we have separate books about each of these things. And he said, if you can pull that off, you will have accomplished something. And that's what I really tried to do.
Do you think there are still certain mysteries here?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are mysteries abounding on both sides. On one hand, for instance, the missing Rose Law Firm documents that Ken Starr's office was looking for and Congress was looking for years, hoping to pin down exactly how much work Hillary Clinton did for Jim McDougal's company, Madison Guarantee, the savings and loan that he was ultimately convicted of, defrauding the federal government with respect to. Those Rose Law Firm documents, as you remember, just kind of appeared on a table in the book room of the White House, and no one seemed to know where they came from. And the First Lady testified in the grand jury that she had not put them there, but that they just kind of appeared, and Carolyn Huber, her assistant, found them. I mean, those documents clearly didn't just get up and walk there. Someone had to put them there. So there remain mysteries. I don't think there was anything that nefarious, but both sides, Leonard, distrusted each other so deeply. I think that a lot of mistakes were made along the way here just because each side thought that the other one was out to get it.
Well, there are all those conspiracy theories that still haven't been cleared up either.
Sure.
Although it's easy to dismiss most of them. But why did Whitewater become a liability to the Clintons? Weren't they cleared of all wrongdoing in the matter eventually?
Well, eventually they were. There was not enough evidence to proceed. I think if you look at the Starr report and others, the conclusion is there was not enough evidence to indict. I wouldn't say that the Starr prosecutors would say that they were cleared. But, look at it this way. You have an individual, Jim McDougal, who ends up being convicted by a jury for SNL scandal, ends up going to jail, and then Bill Clinton is elected president, and he's a business partner of this guy, and he turns out to have certain mental problems and is clearly, kind of doing all sorts of unorthodox things. It's not unusual that the national media would dig into that story. So, again, all of the pieces come together to set this up. Ultimately, did I see any wrongdoing by the Clintons with respect to the Whitewater matter? No, I did not. Is it true that Ken Starr's office drafted an indictment of Hillary Clinton and was seriously considering indicting her and Webster Hubbell on the Whitewater matters as late as 1998? Yes, they were. And then along came Monica Lewinsky, and as one Starr prosecutor said to me, Monica saved Hillary because their focus was turned to that.
My guest is Ken Gormley, interim dean and professor at Duquesne University Law School, specializing in constitutional subjects. His book, The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, which is published by Crown. You mentioned Watergate accidentally, but doesn't the Independent Counsel Act have its roots in the post-Watergate political climate?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I wrote the biography of Archibald Cox, the Watergate special prosecutor who stood up famously to President Nixon and then was fired in the infamous Saturday Night Massacre. Cox himself had a hand in helping to draft the independent counsel law, which was viewed as a good government measure to try to correct some of the problems that occurred during Watergate. So there's no question that all these things are all tied together. And there was, ironically, Ken Starr himself and many of the Republican legal elite of our country were adamantly opposed to the independent counsel law because they thought it, really created this creature who wasn't really accountable to any branch of government. And then fate puts Ken Starr in this position, and in the end, again, ironically, he leaves the Office of Independent Counsel thinking that the statute is tragically flawed.
But how did he come to be appointed Independent Counsel? He was the second choice, wasn't he?
Well, Robert Fisk from New York had been the original appointment by Attorney General Janet Reno. By most accounts, was doing an excellent job moving things along swiftly and wrapping things up. But there were some, and this would be the more conservative wing of the Republican Party at the time, felt that Fisk was kind of covering over some of the Clintons' involvement in Whitewater, and there was pressure to change horses here. And then, the story is filled with ironies. President Clinton signs back into law the independent counsel law, which provides for this three-judge panel to name a special prosecutor. Everyone thought they would just reappoint Fisk, but instead they appointed Kenneth W. Starr.
And I suspect that President Clinton has come to regret reauthorizing that act.
Indeed. He told me that was the single biggest mistake of his presidency.
Although the Democrats had seen it as useful when they were looking into Iran-Contra and
precisely,
some
and
other
Clinton
matters.
Had campaigned in favor of it.
Eventually, the investigation into Watergate spun off into the Paula Jones matter, which then spun into the Lewinsky investigation. How did a real estate deal investigation turn into a sexual misconduct investigation? And did Kenneth Starr really think that Paula Jones or Jennifer Flowers or Monica Lewinsky knew anything about Whitewater?
Well, that's a great question. This is the part where I think that the train, slides off the track, and that is Whitewater. The Whitewater investigation had really just about wrapped up, and I can tell you, Leonard, that I found no evidence of Ken Starr, despite the party line on certain sides, that Ken Starr was this rabid political zealot out to get Bill Clinton. That just doesn't match up with the facts. He did take a long time on the Whitewater investigation, and it dragged on until 97, but it was about wrapping up. And the key pivotal moment was when Ken Starr is about to, he announces he's leaving for Pepperdine Law School. He is just, hit over the head by both sides who say that this is a terrible idea. He changes his mind. And Bob Woodward, who I interviewed for this, broke the story, and he told me this was the moment right then in the early spring of 97, Ken Starr's agents and prosecutors start investigating, interviewing women in Arkansas about past sexual liaisons. Now, they told me that this was really done to just be thorough and to talk to people to whom Clinton might have discussed the Whitewater matter. But according to Bob Woodward, something changed here. And it was from there, then we have Linda Tripp coming to Ken Starr's prosecutors and telling them about Monica Lewinsky. They go to her house, they wire her, and before you know it, they're working on this case linked to the Paula Jones case that had no connection to Whitewater.
And the Starr report ran about 445 pages, was criticized at the time for being somewhat prurient. What was the purpose of including all that graphic information about sex?
Well, Ken Starr's office told me that was because, unfortunately, they were in this impossible situation. The lying involved lying about whether or not President Clinton had had sexual relations, and that involved very specific questions. I will say that one of the more surprising discoveries for me was that President Clinton was in some hot soup here when we get to August of 98 and his grand jury testimony, and he was there was a lot of pressure by Democrats in the Senate to force him to resign, which a lot of folks didn't know. And ironically, as a number of people told me who were close to the Clinton White House at the time, it was actually the Starr report that backfired. It was so over the top in terms of, all of this detail that really galvanized the Democrats, brought Democrats back into the fold who were wavering at the time, and ironically galvanized even Hillary Clinton, who was the aggrieved spouse here, but when, as one person said, this was her anger, and when Ken Starr was trying to use it as a political weapon against her husband, that really reinforced her support for President Clinton.
Did Clinton score any points when he compared the investigation to a Stalinist show trial?
I think that, all of the actors here by this point had just become so convinced that their side was right and the other side was out to do the men that everyone at this point, it had reached almost, as you remember, a stage of hysteria, and that's when it spirals into the attempt to impeach President Clinton in Congress.
My guest is Ken Gormley, interim dean and professor at Duquesne University Law School, specializing in constitutional subjects and author of a number of books, including the biography of Archibald Cox. His latest, The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, which is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ken Gormley of Duquesne University Law School, author of The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, published by Crown. We were talking about some of the mysteries of this story, and one of the ones that has remained mysterious to me is how Paula Jones actually got pulled into this story.
Well, Paula Jones obviously stepped forward herself in bringing her claims against President Clinton at the very early stages of his presidency. What was one of the most interesting discoveries for me, one of the pieces of evidence that Bob Bennett, President Clinton's lawyer, intended to use if this ever went to trial, was this raw footage that had been taken of Paula Jones, where she's trying to actively get the national media to get interested in this story. It had been taken for the Clinton Chronicles, which was a decidedly anti-Clinton film. And if you watch the raw footage, it does not paint someone who it looks like a really aggrieved victim. Paula herself does not come off looking like that. In fact, she's kind of irreverent and cracking jokes and blowing raspberries into the camera. And my assessment was that would not have helped her case. There were a lot of other problems with the case, but
she was also being prompted, wasn't she?
Well, sure. She had her husband, Steve Jones, clearly intensely disliked Bill Clinton, and she was then helped by a PR expert, Susan Carpenter McMillan. One of the other just amazing discoveries in this, Leonard, was that I talked to her Virginia lawyers, and they believed that they did settle the case with President Clinton's lawyer. All of them had reached agreement in 97, before Monica Lewinsky even came on the scene, to settle for the full amount Paula Jones had asked for in her original complaint, $700,000. And because Stephen Jones and Susan Carpenter McMillan were pushing on Paula, she refused to accept the settlement deal, and her lawyers ended up quitting. And right before they quit, I found this remarkable document where they wrote to Paula pleading her to accept this. It was the full amount that they had asked for, and saying that if she went to trial, the most she would ever recover, if anything, was $50,000 because the case was so weak. And she refused to go along with the settlement, and they withdrew. They quit, feeling they could no longer represent her.
You report that Linda Tripp told you she was never out to get Bill Clinton. But in looking at the way she behaved, some people might not see it that way, because she made all those tapes of Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, she was a very complicated figure, and I met with her several times. I actually liked Linda Tripp. She's a very smart woman, but clearly conflicted, I would say almost paranoid at a certain point, thinking that the White House was out to get her. I think one piece of her really thought that the American public deserved to know the story about President Clinton and the fact that he was having this affair with a young intern. But the reality is she had developed an intense dislike for President Clinton and the Clinton White House well before that, was talking about doing a book. You know, she was the last person, one of the last people to see Vince Foster alive. She was his secretary and was talking about doing a book about some of the unusual circumstances around that. So Linda Tripp ends up being a very complex figure in this.
And didn't she worry that the White House was going to put out a hit on her?
Yeah, she told me that, and she said that one day she came back to her desk and there was a note there listing all of the people who had been killed by the Clintons, and she presumed that meant she was next or whatever. But I think she actually came to believe that a truck would hit her in the middle of the night or something like that. And it just became the story. You could not have made up this story, Leonard. It was crazier than fiction.
What did the report by former Justice Department lawyer Joanne Harrison cover about the Office of the Independent Counsel's handling of the Monica Lewinsky matter?
Well, this was one of the big discoveries in writing the book. There was this secret investigation, if you will, of Ken Starr's investigation that was commissioned by the Justice Department to look into certain allegations of misconduct, specifically Starr's office's handling of the Monica Lewinsky sting in the Ritz-Carlton. Joanne Harris, who had been head of the criminal division of the Justice Department, was appointed by Ken Starr's successor, Robert Ray, to look into this. That report had been kept under seal. The public never got to see it. Joanne Harris felt strongly that the American public did deserve to know what was in that. I agreed with her. And the fact is that her report was not complimentary at all of Ken Starr's office's handling of the Monica Lewinsky sting. She told me that she would not have touched that case with a 10-foot pole, especially after Monica Lewinsky asked not once but repeatedly to talk to the lawyer who had drafted her affidavit, Robert Carter, and Starr's prosecutors really kind of hemmed and hawed and dissuaded her from doing that. So that turns out to be a pretty big blemish on the record of the Office of Independent Counsel, and it had been hidden from public view until this time.
And Starr's office wanted to suppress the Harris report.
Yeah, well, their belief was that it involved private information relating to some of their prosecutors. Now, I will say that part of it was a little unfair because some of the prosecutors, many of the prosecutors had left, and only a couple of people were still on the staff holding the bag. But the fact remains that in this investigation, what Joanne Harris said, and I agree with her, I mean, virtually every private detail of people's lives was hung out to dry here, including raw grand jury testimony, and it just seemed appropriate that information of this sort relating to the conduct of the Office of Independent Counsel the public should know about as well.
And then there were all sorts of other things that seemed to happen. Didn't the Starr team essentially pit the Secret Service against the FBI?
Not the Starr team. No, it was the FBI and the Secret Service coming to blows. It was kind of like a spy versus spy thriller. The FBI was really becoming aligned strongly with Ken Starr's investigation. The Secret Service, which was sworn to protect the president, Lou Merletti, the head of the Secret Service at the time, did a series of interviews with me and told his story for the first time. It was just amazing. He was aghast that Starr's office would try to subpoena his agents and make them talk about what they had seen or not seen in the Oval Office, because that was the essence of being able to protect the president. But he also disclosed that at certain points he believed the FBI was trying to set him up, and specifically a high-level FBI official pulled him aside shortly before President Clinton's grand jury testimony and told him, "Don't worry, there's no DNA on the dress." And he believed the goal was to get him to bring that back to President Clinton and have him testify the wrong way under oath and to ensnare both of them. So this was skullduggery, I guess, is one word, at the highest level.
Starr even admits later on that he regretted looking into the Lewinsky matter, saying it had to be investigated, but I was a poor choice to do it. Why did he come to believe that he'd been the wrong man for the job?
Well, Ken Starr is actually a fine person, an excellent lawyer. I have great respect for him. And I do have to say that I did not find him to be this partisan nut or zealot throughout the Whitewater investigation. I think I may have mentioned it took a long time, but I didn't see any personal attempt to topple the presidency. But when he gets to the Monica Lewinsky investigation, wholly different than what's covered by his charter, which is Whitewater, I think it was a terrible mistake for him to go anywhere near that. I've told that to Ken. You know, someone else, if it was going to be investigated, someone else would not have the baggage he had at that point, which was that half the country, rightly or wrongly, perceived him to have an axe to grind here. And the other piece of it is that he had actually done some work. It wasn't a lot, but he had done some work relating to the Paula Jones case. For all those reasons, I think it was a tragic mistake. But he's come to look back on it and concluded that because so many people at that point had taken sides in this matter, it probably would have been wise if someone else had done it.
What was his relationship like with Attorney General Janet Reno?
Well, that's a great question. I interviewed Janet Reno at her home down in Florida. She's a woman of very few words, you may know, but you know, very careful in her selection of words. And I asked her first of all, she said clearly she thought it was a mistake to appoint Ken Starr because he had no prosecutorial experience. She admired him, but he wasn't the right person to do this. When I asked her about his handling of the Lewinsky matter and specifically the Starr report, she kind of clenched her teeth and said, "I would have done it differently."
Didn't our current Attorney General, Eric Holder, also play a role in the story?
Yes, he did. He was the person who Ken Starr's deputy, Jackie Bennett, went to tell him that they had gotten this information from Linda Tripp, that they had wired her, and that they wanted permission to expand into the Lewinsky matter. Eric Holder got me notes from that time that had not been disclosed before, and they clearly showed, at least according to his view of things, that Ken Starr's deputies had pushed very hard that they wanted the Lewinsky matter. This wasn't something that the Attorney General just handed over to them. It turned out that Ken Starr and Eric Holder, ended up being, let's put it this way, Ken Starr believed that Eric Holder was trying to besmirch the reputation of the Office of Independent Counsel and talking to the media. Eric Holder told me that that was not the case, but there was certainly animosity developed between those two camps. And ultimately, Eric Holder told me that if he had it to do over, although there was enormous pressure to move on this thing and to appoint someone, he probably would have recommended to the Attorney General appointing someone different as well.
We had Susan McDougall on our show at one point, I think right after she'd been released from prison. She called Ken Starr Satan. And Jim McDougall died in prison, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, I interviewed Susan McDougall extensively, and I do disclose in the book that she did have, it's not just that I believe, I state categorically that she did have an affair with then-Governor Clinton of a short duration. I do not reveal my sources, and I will not reveal my sources. However, I also concluded that that was not the reason she refused to testify. She refused to testify, as you said, Leonard. She clearly hated Ken Starr, hated him because she believed that no matter what she told him and his prosecutors, she was going to go to jail if she didn't give information incriminatory of President and Mrs. Clinton, and she had no such evidence. And she told me she saw her ex-husband, Jim, turned into a craven liar, as she said, as he just spun stories and tried to make up things to con the Office of Independent Counsel so that he could avoid going to jail. So she figured she was going to jail one way or the other. She was not going to cooperate with him.
My guest is Ken Gormley. His book, The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, is published by Crown. You interviewed pretty much every major player in the case. Was it difficult to get certain people who might not want to go over this again, like President Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, even Ken Starr, to speak with you?
It took years. The first person I went to was Ken Starr, and that's because I had written a lot about this during as the events were unfolding, because I had written that biography of Archibald Cox that came out right about that time. And most of what I would have written, Leonard, would have been viewed as pro-Clinton in the sense that I did not think that these were impeachable offenses. But I had great respect for Ken Starr, and I did not want to write this book if I did not get cooperation from both sides. I felt very strongly about that. So fortunately, Ken Starr agreed to cooperate. Then his prosecutors cooperated. It took several years to get Monica Lewinsky to cooperate. I did that through approaching one of her lawyers, Plato Kacharis. And then President Clinton, I spent a lot of time in Arkansas with friends of his from his childhood, with his mother's best friends, and also with his lawyers. And eventually, it took about 5 years, but eventually he had enough trust that he was willing to cooperate. The only person who did not sit down with me was Hillary Clinton, but she decided to run for president in the meantime, and I can certainly respect why she would choose not to do that.
It's interesting that Plato Kacharis also represented defendants in the Watergate trial. So
very good. You know your facts. That's absolutely correct. You know, Washington's a small town, and there are so many links between people who had roles in Watergate and people who were linked to this. And frankly, that was the most important calling card I had, that I had written this book about Archibald Cox, a hero of Watergate, who and it was viewed as balanced, and that was, I think, the most significant entree to my getting access to these people.
How would you compare the job that Archibald Cox did in investigating the Nixon White House with the one that Ken Starr did with Clinton?
Well, I guess it goes to the title of the book here again. I spent a lot of time with Archibald Cox. He had been my law professor at Harvard. He wasn't a prosecutor either, if you remember, Leonard, but he had this innate sense of a prosecutor's job to stay away from the political stuff and to restrain his own team. And so he and Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, would go huddle and isolate themselves from their own staffs, who were, like prosecutors do, pushing and wanting to get at the targets to make decisions that they thought were best for the country. And so there was a real built-in sense of self-restraint. And I think Ken Starr, and again, this isn't a condemnation, he's a wonderful person, but he was a judge, and he didn't have this innate sense of what prosecutors do, and maybe that's good. But as a result, he deferred quite a bit to these prosecutors kind of rattling the cages, wanting to charge ahead, and they did just that. And so there was a decided difference in terms of the restraint that was going on in making key decisions.
Was there ever any concern in the Clinton White House that the president wouldn't survive the impeachment trial and would be removed from office?
Oh, sure. It was very intense, I would say, especially in that period after his grand jury testimony, where he confessed after months of saying, you know, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, and then all of a sudden admitting to the affair. I talked to a number of White House staffers who thought that it was possible the jig was up at that point, and the Democrats themselves. Don't forget, it was the Republicans who forced Richard Nixon to resign. It was his own party. And that was their biggest concern here, the Democrats in Congress. And again, the irony was that Ken Starr's report, the Starr report, was viewed as so over the top that it really reunited the Democrats in their resolve to fight Ken Starr and brought them back aboard, and Hillary Clinton back aboard with President Clinton.
Some people have suggested that if Starr had sped up the investigation, Clinton would have been seriously wounded. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he was seriously wounded. I think if he had sped up the investigation, what should have happened really is Congress should have done its own investigation here. And I could say that Ken Starr's office and his prosecutors genuinely seemed shocked and dismayed that Congress never did anything of its own but just took the Starr report wholesale, disgorged it to the public, and based its entire impeachment efforts on that. But I think one way or the other, even if you remove Ken Starr from this picture, Leonard, again, you have the train barreling down the track at President Clinton, which is the Paula Jones case. And that's something that he was going to have to deal with at a certain point, no matter what, having to answer questions having to do with other women, including Monica Lewinsky.
People may forget that there was a current of paranoia on both sides of the aisle during the story. There were accusations that President Clinton was wearing ties that Monica Lewinsky had given him in order to send her signals, and that the gold stripes that the Chief Justice William Rehnquist wore on his robes while presiding over the impeachment trial were also part of some code system.
Well, the stripes on the Rehnquist robes were because he had watched a Gilbert and Sullivan play and liked the stripes on one of the judge's robes. So that's pretty clear. But I can tell you that the ties is more interesting. I included in the book a picture of President Clinton wearing one of Monica's ties that said, "Thanks for the birthday present," or something, that is the first time that picture was published. Monica Lewinsky, for her, ties were important. She had worked in a tie shop. She always said they were important because they were close to your heart. She was convinced that President Clinton consciously wore ties that she gave him because that was kind of a sign between them. But she also did not think that he was trying to get her to lie or signal in that sense. It was more just a sign of solidarity. But she did not think that the wearing of the ties was accidental.
It's interesting that both parties were hurt by the impeachment proceedings. Top House Republicans lost elections, and there were any number of scandals that the Republican Party had to deal with as a result. On the other hand, George Bush won the presidency in 2000.
Right. That was one of the interesting things that Henry Hyde said to me. You know, Henry Hyde, I did a number of interviews before he died. He was the leader of the House managers who sought to impeach President Clinton. And he said, well, at the end of the day, at least he had the satisfaction of knowing that he had done his duty, and if they hadn't done their duty, George W. Bush probably would not have been elected, and also President Clinton would always go down in history with an asterisk next to his name as the second president ever impeached by the House. When I told that to President Clinton, he said, well, I hope that I have two asterisks, and the second asterisk is that I beat them, and I beat them like a yard dog. So I do believe there's something to the fact that all of this contributed to Al Gore's defeat. President Clinton disagrees with that, obviously. But there is no question that the sides have dramatically different views about how history should view this.
Although Bill Clinton seems to have come out of it at this point fairly unscathed. He is now, he's involved, before he had his heart problem, he was involved in the Haitian relief. He's been involved
right.
in other humanitarian efforts. So perhaps he will be treated more kindly by history.
Well, I think so. And in fact, it's funny. I was interviewed at the time, I remember, after the House impeached President Clinton. And I remember saying to a reporter, well, history is a very interesting thing, and it isn't written until it's completely written. And a president has a long career even after he or she leaves the White House. And so you're exactly right. I think what the House managers really underestimated is they thought that this would, even if they could force this through and get an impeachment vote in the House, somehow that would have an impact forever. And very honestly, you're exactly right, Leonard. What is more important is what is Bill Clinton doing and what is Hillary Clinton doing, even in these years afterward, that is going to be just as important or more important in terms of their legacies.
Ken Gormley is interim dean and professor at Duquesne University Law School. His latest book, The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr, published by Crown. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Leonard. It was a real pleasure.